All right, it's nice to meet everyone. My name is Yaakov Glasser. I live in Passaic, New Jersey. I have two lives, really. I'm the Rav of a shul there called the Young Israel, Passaic Clifton. Very exciting Monday night. We're going for our zoning board to get approval for our new building, so we're all very much in the shul building mode. And then I'm also the regional director of NCSY for New Jersey. I know I'm in New York now, but there is places outside New York. And in New Jersey, we have our own NCSY region. I'm close friends with your regional director, Rabbi Lightstone. We've been close friends for many years. But I run NCSY in New Jersey. And so Mr. Brookwhite asked if I would come address you on this topic. So a word of introduction, I think is in order. This Shabbos, you know, we were in Vayakel, another Mishkan parasha. And in the depiction of the Mishkan, one of the elements that's listed at the end is the kior. And as we all know, the kior was essentially the basin that the Kohanim would use to wash their hands and wash their feet before performing the avoda in the Mishkan or in the Beis HaMikdash. And the kior, the Torah tells us, was constructed out of mirrors, out of maros. And many of us are familiar with the famous Rashi that discusses a dialogue between God and HaKadosh, between God, I guess, see, too many hours on the, you know what it is? It's like the 10-10 wind, just going over and over, like, every 22 minutes, I'm just going to give you the world. There's nothing I can't stop going over in my head. I know every business story, the last, and I know where we're holding with Gaddafi perfectly. So there's a dialogue between Moshe and HaKadosh Baruch Hu, quoted by Rashi. Where Moshe says to Hashem, what are you putting mirrors in the kior? Mirrors represent vanity. Mirrors represent self-reflection. Mirrors represent an absorption in things that are ephemeral, and things that are physical, and things that are temporal. Well, what do mirrors have to do with the Beis HaMikdash? So HaKadosh Baruch Hu responds to him that these are very special mirrors, because they've been donated by the women, and they were utilized in a time of very great difficulty, in the period of Mitzrayim and Shibud Mitzrayim, when the Jews were in servitude, and the men were so exhausted and beaten down from the experience of the shibud, of the servitude itself, they had no desire to be together, to be intimate with their wives, and therefore it was going to be a breakdown in terms of the mesorah, in terms of the tradition of the Jewish people. So these mirrors were the mirrors that the women utilized in order to make themselves look attractive, so that their husbands would desire them, and ultimately they would be able to perpetuate the Jewish people. Very special mirrors. And the whole concept that we're familiar with, the whole notion that we elevate the physical in Judaism, we don't suppress it, we don't denigrate it. But the Magen Mimezrich has a beautiful thought, completely different idea, because that doesn't really explain why the mirrors are in the kior itself, this specific basin that is used to prepare the Kohanim. So the Magen Mimezrich says so beautifully, the reason why the mirrors comprise the kior is because the Kohanim spent all day involved with dealing with other people's problems. Right? That's essentially what would happen. You come to the Beis HaMikdash, you would have committed some sort of sin, and therefore you needed to bring a karban, you needed to bring a sacrifice, and you needed to have this avodah and that avodah, you had this prayer, you had that prayer. So all day, these guys were dealing with other people's issues, with other people's problems, with other people's challenges, with other people's failures. Says the Magen Mimezrich, before you begin your day dealing with other people's problems, the first thing you have to do is look in the mirror and take a look at yourself and see your own reflection and make sure that before you start preaching to everybody else, that you are yourself an embodiment of those values. And that's obviously a wonderful introduction to our topic for today, and also a great introduction to my personal kior moment on my way here this evening, because I ran out of shul because I was determined to get here on time. And I ran out of shul. I come home. My wife prepared Abdullah right away. Make Abdullah. I'm about to shoot out into the car. And Chaim Glasser, who is 8 years old, comes walking up to me with a mishnayis. Chaim, what's going on? Abba, are we going to Avos Ubanim? Right? Say it. Right? We got ourselves a father-son learning program. So I said, Chaim, I'm sorry. I can't go to Avos Ubanim tonight. So he said, 3 weeks ago you couldn't go because you were leaving Teretz Yisrael. 2 weeks ago you couldn't go because you had a meeting. Last week you couldn't go because you had a bar mitzvah. What's going on tonight that you can't take me to Avos Ubanim? Chaim, I'm going to give a parenting lecture. So, for all of us, parenting is very difficult. Parenting is very challenging. I'm not better at it than anybody else is, and I don't pretend to stand before you here as any form of authority or sense of perfection. And I do not think we're living in a world or living in an age where we can expect perfection from ourselves. Life is very overwhelming. Life is very stressful. Life is very difficult. The balance of quality time and quantity time, we could talk from here to tomorrow, but it's like any of us who've been to these management seminars. Everything sounds great in the seminar, right? Everything makes sense with the goal setting and the metrics and the achievements and the this and the, everything sounds great in the seminar. And then you get back to your office and everything's tough, right? Because there are seminars and there's reality. And the reality of our homes and the reality of our lives and the vicissitudes that we face in our daily interactions with our children, with our peers, with our bosses, with everything that's going on is very difficult. And many of these things can't be solved. But I will tell you this. They can be improved. They can be better. And I believe that I can share with you some insights, both from my experience and more importantly from the wisdom of our sages of ages of old, that can help make them better. Our children can be more spiritual. They do not need to wait for the Israel experience in order to become more spiritual. It is very unhealthy on many levels to view the raising of our children as something that is just, we're sort of like in a preservation mode until we can deport them to the Middle East, where we then delegate their emotional, spiritual, and physical health to other people who do this for a living, a pretty good living, right? And we're now 7,000 miles away. That is not the ideal. Going to our Tesorah for the year is absolutely the ideal. That's a wonderful thing to do. I was just there for a week visiting all our students. They're all doing great. But, as we all know, they do not have to show up there starved for spirituality only to be satisfied by role models who may or may not be in consistency with your particular hashkafas ha'olam. There is a way to give them in our homes, in our communities, in our shuls, in our schools, in our environments, nurturing from us a sense of spirituality, a sense of seriousness, a sense of commitment, a sense of passion, enthusiasm, and love for Yahadus that becomes the foundation upon which they can involve themselves in many different opportunities to build on that foundation. But their foundation should always be with us. And the way that foundation begins at home, we're going to discuss now. So let's focus for a moment on the problem. Let's try to frame the problem. And I turn to a Gemara in Shabbos to frame the problem. A quite a famous Gemara. And the Gemara comes in the following context. A few weeks ago was Parshas Yisro. My daughter Ne'ima, she's 7 years old, she came home with the story of Kabbalah Satorah, right? The typical 7-year-old story of Kabbalah Satorah. What happened in Kabbalah Satorah? Oh, Abba, it was amazing. Hashem wanted to give the Torah to the Jewish people. He went to all the other nations, said, do you want the Torah? They said, oh, what's in it? Oh, this is in it. Oh, I don't want the Torah. Then he went to the Jewish people, and there's a little Harsinai, and it has grass, and it's singing, and it's talking, and it's dancing, and it's laughing, and it's, oh, so wonderful. And he says to the Jewish people, do you want the Torah? And the Jewish people say, Nasa v'nishma. Of course we want the Torah. We don't even care what's in the Torah. We don't want to know how hard it is. We don't know about the cost of tuition. We don't want to know about anything. Nasa v'nishma. No matter what it's going to be, we're in. Right? And that's the story we give them. But we all know that as they grow older, that story of Nasa v'nishma as being their religious consciousness begins to be challenged dramatically. That is the world of Nasa v'nishma, of proactive, enthusiastic, you know, coming to the world of religion from a disposition of motivation and passion and desire for growth. That's the Nasa v'nishma in the moment. We all know that the Gemara in Shabbos depicts much more accurately what many of us experience the world of religion to really be. And that is, the Gemara tells a very different story. For some reason, the Babylonian nursery schools did not influence the Talmudic academies properly. The Gemara says, the Jewish people sat at the bottom of the mountain. Okay? We're now outside the world of nursery school. What really happened, says the Gemara? HaKadosh Baruch Hu holds a mountain over their head. V'omar lahem, and he says to them, here's the deal, it's very simple. Right? They never made this into a 613 Torah Avenue song. V'omar lahem, and they said to him, if atem mekavim haTorah, if you're going to accept the Torah, mutav, wonderful, you'll live a great life, and everything will be good, and you'll thrive, and you'll grow, and you'll have a great life experience. V'im lahem, and if you don't, Shom tehei kvuraschem. I'm going to very gently drop this mountain on top of you and bury you alive. And that's the it. That's it. That's what it's going to be. Now, by the way, the average kid sitting in Yeshiva High School This is their relief. This is how they experience religion. This is how they experience religion. In other words, everyone tells them you have a choice. Everyone tells them, Ray, you know, you could be Machayim, there's some of this, there's a Tol, there's a right. You have a choice. You could, and what's the choice? The choice is you could either embrace the message that we're trying to send you, right? And everything will be good. Or you could decide that Judaism is not for you, right? And this is your choice, and you could be damned to hell for eternity, right? It's your choice. It's your choice. We're not forcing it down your throat. You know, everybody gets to say Nasim and Ishmael. But just so you know, if you read the words of Shema, just so you know, the rain stops and everything dries up and everyone gets sick and everyone dies and everything. And that will show you the Tochacha and, you know, this thing and that thing. Just so you know. But it's your choice. You know, whatever you want to do, you want to do. Now, in a teenage brain, right, in a teenage brain that's starting to begin to develop their own sense of independence and independent thinking, right, when this transition is starting to go on, from the world of, they're just doing the Jewish things because we've trained them to do them, and we'll get into that soon, to the world of, we want them to actually own this decision, right? This is a traumatic evolution. This is a traumatic transition. Wow, is that water? Amazing. Thank you. I spent the last 2.5 hours just talking to this one woman who just kept giving me directions. So the Maharal asks this question. The Maharal looks at this Gemara and says, what's going on? I don't understand, right? And the Rishonim already deal with this, right? What's going on? How does this story in the Gemara of God holding the mountain over their head, how does that story somehow correspond to the Psukim in the Torah that seem to depict a much more proactive Jewish nation? That's not doing this under duress. That's expressing their internal motivation of Nasev and Ishmael. And the Maharal makes the following point. You look at the third line, Mevorah Maharal, and some of these insights are taken from a sefer that I picked up when I was in Israel a few weeks ago. I forget what it's called, but it's by Rav Aviner's son, and it's on Chinuch. Rav Aviner wrote... We're working from here. Number two. I can't remember his first name. But his last name is Aviner. Rav Aviner Sr. wrote 2 volumes on Chinuch. So the son, obviously, you know, what does the father know about Chinuch, right? So the son wrote a sefer on Chinuch, right? So the father's svarim a little more psychological, a little more typical Rav Aviner style. The son's svarim are a little bit more Hasidish. Anyway, he quotes this Maharal, and he writes the following. It's a famous Maharal, but I think the insight of the Maharal helps frame our problem and our discussion. Shakfiya nova'as mikach she'i efshar la'olam b'lo Torah. Akein en roi shetia kabolas ha'Torah v'bechiras Yisrael. Says the Maharal the following. This is in a nutshell what he is trying to convey. The following idea. That what does it mean that we depict the Nasav and Nishma experience as one of coercion? Right? What is it? Is it choice or is it coercion? So says the Maharal, it's both. In other words, what we are striving for here is an innate and internal sense of compelling desire to do the right thing, to make these choices, to the point where the coercion is almost superfluous. In other words, the imagery of the mountain over our head is that this is life. This is the only life we would ever choose, because this is the life we want. But it's not that this is the life we want, but tomorrow maybe we'll want a different life, because there are external factors, you know, asking us, do we want to go in this direction or that direction? There's an internal desire to do the right thing. There is innate passion to embrace the right path. In other words, it's something that is not being done because someone sold it to you. It's something that's not being done because it's being forced down your throat. It's something that's coming from you. It becomes internal. It becomes your sense of what life is all about. We all know there are certain aspects of our life, right? We're here tonight exploring how to, you know, be better at raising our children in various ways, right? So we all know our children, it's part of our life. It's not like we make conscious choices to care about them, to not care about them. It's not like we wake up one morning and, you know, thank God, you know, we make a chart. Let's see, this morning, you know, are they really worth it, right? So I don't know if that's a great topic on Motzei Shabbos, right? After we've been through all the play dates and, you know, God knows what else, right? Are they really worth it? Well, you know, here are the cons, here are the pros. That's not how you deal with your children. It's life or death. That's it. It's compelling. It's innate. It is what it is. It's, says the Maharal, that is what Kabbalah HaTorah is supposed to be. That is what we're striving for. We're striving to instill within these children an innate proactive desire to do the right thing and to grow and to embrace spirituality and to embrace what it is that we're doing. So every time we knock on their door, you know, I know we're focused more on girls, but girls, God, anytime we knock on their door to wake them up for davening, right, and they say, go away, and we're pushing, and we've dragged them out of bed, and now we just, you know, and all these other things. So we have to recognize, sometimes that's necessary. Sometimes you have to do that, right? Anytime you have that confrontation in the hallway about what she is or isn't going to wear, sometimes you have to do that. Sometimes that's necessary. But if that's the totality of their religious experience, if that is the complete picture for them, if it's always external to them, we have to recognize that once they leave the cocoon of the home that is constantly badgering them to do these things, ultimately they're not going to have the internal, you know, locus of desire to make the right choices for themselves, which is what we're trying to instill within them. And a lot of this has to do with the teenage years. Because the teenage years are very difficult to pin down on many levels, but the most challenging level is this shift, which is like, is this kid a child? Because often they behave like a child. Or is this kid an adult? Because they want to be treated like an adult. Is this kid a child? Because they make stupid decisions with terrible consequences without thinking, right? Like my 8-year-old, right? Or is this child an adult? Because suddenly they're sitting at the Shabbos table and opining on the latest, you know, controversy with intelligent thoughts and ideas, and they want to be heard, and they want to be validated, and they want to be understood, and they want to be listened to. Are they a child? Are they adult? Are they a child? Are they adult? That struggle with their development in general from a psychological and emotional perspective is also going on within them from a spiritual perspective. And we have to know what tools are available to us to manage that transition so that they emerge the same way you want them to emerge in a mature fashion from the perspective of their growth intellectually and emotionally. You want them to emerge maturely spiritually. And very often, we are incredibly infantilizing to our children, to our teenagers, when it comes to the areas of religion and spirituality. Our approach is basically the same from 4 years old all through the rest, and we don't realize how much we have failed to sort of make that transition, and that's what we're going to focus on a little bit. The first piece that's important to understand when dealing with the emerging teenager, the emerging identity, is the whole notion of what chinuch is altogether. I'm not going to read all these sources inside because I really want to get to the practical parts, but I leave it for you to explore. The Piasechna Rebbe, right, wrote a very important book called Chovas HaTalmidim. It is available in Hebrew and in English. It is a gem. It is a wonderful book to read. It is not about how terrible a kid is. It is about how amazing. And it's written it's addressed to the teenager themselves. Within that book, he makes the following point called the Chovas HaTalmidim, a student's obligation. It's available in Hebrew and in English. It's an amazing, amazing work. From the first sentence, you'll see how it's different than all the other.
Who was the author?
The Piasechna Rebbe. Piasechna Rebbe. Colonimus. Okay, so he writes the following, and here's his basic point. The word chinuch, when we talk about the word chinuch, right? So we relate to the word chinuch as to teach, to build, right? Different. So the Torah uses the word chinuch in the following context. The Torah talks about, if you remember, in the Parshios and Devarim, when the Torah is discussing people who go out to war. So there are certain people that are not obligated to go out to war, certain types of wars on behalf of the Jewish people. One of them is somebody who is mechanech beiso, they've been mechanech their home, but they haven't lived in their home. So he points out that this word chinuch, right, this word chinuch, very often we think it means to build, to create, to fashion, from nothing, right? And that's what we're trying to do. He says that the word chinuch does not mean, when we talk about Chanukah Sabayis, when we talk about Chanukah Sabayis, what are we talking about? We're not talking about the laying the cornerstone. That's not a Chanukah Sabayis. Chanukah Sabayis is when the building is complete, and what begins? The usage of the building, pulling out the potential of the building, right? Reaching within that building and ensuring that you can actualize everything within it and allow it to manifest its glory through being used, through being, you know, shared with other people. That's a Chanukah Sabayis. See, right? That's what chinuch is. Chinuch is not creating a child. There are many aspects of the child that are not within our capacity to create or to destroy. they come to us with certain spiritual genetics, with certain physical genetics. We can't control how tall they are, Lord knows. We can't control how short they are. We can't control what they look like, you know, without majorly manipulating who they are, you know, fundamentally in their physical sense. With their spirituality, the same is true as well. Everyone thinks that when it comes to the physical and emotional child, you have to work with the givens. But when it comes to the spiritual development of the child, for some reason a parent's obligated to create yesh me'ayin, something from nothing. It's not true. Children are born with certain proclivities from a spiritual perspective as well. Some of them are more emotionally spiritual. Some of them are more rationally spiritual. Some of them are not spiritual at all. Some of them have trouble with the whole concept of something abstract like God. Some of them have trouble with authority as it relates to God. Not all of this is within our control, which is another way of saying not all of this is our fault. What is our fault is to fail to recognize what the package is that we've been given and how to best cater to the strengths and weaknesses of that particular child in order to help the child extract their potential. Every child has a neshama, every child has a spiritual core. And the path to that spiritual core is different for every child. And therefore, it is our job as parents to find the individual approach. And that brings us to the famous concept of Chanoch Lenar al Pi Darko. And this I want to talk about a little bit. If you turn to the back of the page. This we're going to focus on a little bit. Chanoch lenar al pi darko, right? Which literally translated means one is supposed to educate a child lefi darko, according to their path. It's a recognition by Shlomo HaMelech that every child is an individual, that every child is different. The Medrash tells us the first thing we say when we wake up in the morning is mode ani, right? The first thing we say when we wake up in the morning is mode ani. I still get nervous when I go to my kids' parent-teacher conferences. You know, it's like a Pavlovian response. You know, to parent-teacher conference night. The first thing we say is mode ani, and the medrash. Where is this mode ani? Right. Where is this? Wake up in the morning. Mode ani lefanecha melachai v'kem shechzar to bidi. Turn me nishmasi my soul bechem l'rabe munasecha. So the medrash says that the verse writes the following. The pasuk writes biyarcha afki ruchi padisa osi Hashem kelemes. That every night we give our soul back to God. And there's an amazing medrash in Medrash Tehillim that says the following. Why is it called a pikadon? Why is it called that we deposit it with God? Because every night God takes all of the souls up to heaven. It's a little esoteric, just follow me. All the souls back to heaven and then returns them to earth in the morning, right? When the alarm goes off. So says the medrash, how do you know, right, that everybody gets the right soul back, right? Maybe I'll wake up, right, with your soul, and you'll wake up with my soul, and then everybody's like it's like a horror movie, right? Everybody's like switching. So the Medrash depicts this possibility, and the Medrash writes, this is what it means that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is a pikad, that the souls are a pikado, that God ensures that each soul goes back to the right person, and that's why the first thing when you say when you wake up in the morning, even though so much of tefillah is in lashon rabim, is in all about us. The first thing we say when we wake up in the morning is all in singular. Mode ani lefanecha, shechzarta bi nishmasi. It's all in the singular. Because the first thing we say when we wake up in the morning is we embrace our spiritual individuality. The Medrash tells us, k'shem sheparts v'seim min ha'shavos, kach nishmasim min ha'shavos. Just like everyone's face, no two faces are alike. Everyone's face is different. So too a face is called panim. It's reflective of what's inside. No two souls are the same. Every soul is different. And therefore, if you want to access the spiritual acumen of a particular child, the first thing that we need to do is try to get into that child's soul. The same way when we want a child to be academically successful, and we put them in a classroom with lots of other kids and teach them all the same way, and lo and behold, they're not successful. So what do? We take a step back, we sit down with the school psychologist, with the principal, with the teacher, whatever it is, and we start trying to figure out, how does this child learn? How does this child process? The same is true. Kishen Shepard, same in and shovels, just like their psychological dynamics are all all individualized, so too are their spiritual dynamics. But we don't treat them this way. We sort of just spread out a spiritual net and expect everyone to react and respond to the same thing. Our Shabbos experience is monolithic at our table. Our tefillah experience is certainly that way. And we expect everyone to spiritually react and respond in the same way. Chanoch l'nar al pi darko is a confrontation with the reality that every child is spiritually different. And this is something that we need to begin to think about. So say the Mefarshim. So what does this mean, chanoch l'nar al pi darko? So I brought here for you four different explanations. Each one incredibly beautiful. The first is the Sefer Hasidim, okay? I don't know that this is the best thing to show the, you know, a curriculum specialist, because it's a very difficult way to educate, but it's important for us to know. The Sefer Hasidim writes the following. Chanoch l'nar al pi darko, im tira sheyatzliach b'mikra, v'lo b'talmud, al tidchok lo hasha l'lamdo talmud. V'im yobin talmud, al tidchok oso l'lamdo mikra, b'ma sheyodeya tanchin chuvu. In other words, if a child finds themselves more drawn to Chumash, because Chumash is more of a moral and ethical legacy of a people, and Chumash is more concrete and grounded, and Chumash is less abstract, and you can deal with psukim and verses and literary, you know, if you find that the child is drawn to that, don't force him into a box that says that he has to learn Gemara all day. And if you find that the child is drawn to the rational thinking and the abstract analysis and the conceptual manipulations of Gemara and analysis and lumbus and those kinds of things, then don't try to stick him in a literary class and have him analyze patterns in Tanakh, 1, 2, 3, 4, and what this parallels this and this parallels that. He can't do it. In other words, one has to identify how best... What one has to identify what speaks to that child. In other words, what element of Yahadus speaks to that child. And that's not just about the subjects he's talking about. He's talking about things in general. For certain children, Shabbos is a spiritual experience. For certain teenagers, Shabbos is something they can connect to. Very few of them for all 25 hours, but a moment. Candlelighting, a davening, a shalom aleichem, a bracha, a moment at the meal, a moment, you know, on Motzei Shabbos, you know, at Havdalah. For many of them, it is a moment that they can connect to. For some of them, it is absolutely 25 hours of torture, right? And sitting them down and just forcing it down their throat more and more and more and more will not necessarily reach them. Now, does that mean we just let them be Mechalal Shabbos? Absolutely not. But one of the things we're trying to determine is how to insert as much of the Aseh Tov as possible. In other words, we're trying to build a spiritual foundation of a kid. And so we're looking for the elements that speak to them. The elements that don't speak to them have to be managed in terms of expectations, in terms of, you know, what you need in order to be a functioning and firm Jew, but they're not the portal to what will bring this firm person's soul alive. They're not the portal to what will awaken them, right? It's just like school. It's just like learning in school, right? There are certain subjects, there are certain expectations that have to be met. You can't just take a child who hates math and say, you don't have to learn any more math. You don't have to do any more math. There are certain basic abilities that you need to... But math is not going to be the portal through which you're going to awaken the intellectual curiosity of this child and build from there for them to go get a PhD in something mathematical. You're going to have to find that portal, that opening to what speaks to the child. We'll be more specific soon. The Vilna Gaon writes that it's not just about determining what it is that speaks to the child in terms of the subject material or in terms of the item itself, but it's also about the, he writes, Alpi Darko, Derech Mazalo V'Tiv'o. It's also about their own inclination. It's also about becoming aware, especially when they're teenagers, and this is starting to manifest itself, but sometimes obscured by their immaturity. It's also about becoming aware of, what elements of their personality are nurtured and satisfied and edified by engagement with particular aspects of Yiddishkeit. Some kids love the chagiga, love the music, love the chasana, love the emotional moments, love the Yom Kippur, love the, you know, not the oppressive parts, but the, you know, the white, and the some that speaks to some kids. Some kids find that completely stupid and completely empty, and like, who wants to run around in circles and who wants to dance? And they find the intellectual side more stimulating. Some kids will find the social side more stimulating. And the beautiful thing about Yagos is that it's not a religion that, you know, has one exclusive, you know, piece to it, you know, to the detriment of anything else. There are social elements of Yiddishkeit that are beautiful, and there are intellectual elements of Yiddishkeit that are beautiful, and there are more, you know, spiritual and amorphous aspects of Yiddishkeit that are also beautiful. There are, you know, the key is to plug the kid in to the element that speaks to them, to begin to identify what pieces speak to them. And by the way, that's what begins to happen when they go to these programs in Israel, which is they begin to relax all of the, you know, more formal expectations, and they begin to kind of explore all of the different pieces as kind of like a buffet of Yiddishkeit, and they begin to connect to the different elements that, you know, speak to them, and the parts that they don't connect to, no one in the environment is telling them, you're evil, you're terrible, you're bad, because you're not connecting to that. Yes, please.
Question. Sometimes yeah. It's not the right time to ask questions. I'm just thinking of a practical question, but it kind of goes along with you.
Yes, please.
My kids are teenagers, or starting to be teenagers, whatever, and everybody wants to go somewhere different on Shabbos. Everyone wants to go to a different shul. Should we say, you know, because we're always like, we're family, we're together, we want to shkafa, blah, blah, blah.
Excellent.
But to add to, you know, to what you're saying, it sounds like, yeah, you know, if my son likes Eish Kodesh and this one likes this, and like whatever it is that speaks to them, young Israel. And
as long as you know why they're going, right? Like,
it's a, in other words, let's say I don't know why they're going.
Let's put it this way.
They want to go because they're family.
Everything, so great. So everything is a balance. Correct.
Right.
Everything is a balance. Correct. I want to tell you something. I have a shul in my community where I'm very close to the rabbi, and the rabbi came out to me, you know, the other day, not the other day, this time a couple years ago, and he said to me, he was very proud of himself. Why? Because he had couches in the lobby. And what would happen? All the teenagers would hang out on the couches in the lobby. So what do? They got rid of the couches. And he was pretty proud of himself, right? Because now there are no teenagers hanging out in the lobby on the couches. So where are they?
They're not there.
They're on the street. You know, they're like, you know, that's a terrible solution, you know? So, you know, everything's a balance. Is there value to a family going to shul together? Family that plays together, right? Is there value to that? There's value to that. Is that worth compromising the opportunity for a kid to really feel personally enriched by a davening and not feel like they're boxed into this davening? That if this davening is more, they're singing, they're dancing, it's, you know, more that kind of thing, and they love that, then they love that. If you take a kid that hates singing and you stick them in a shul, you know what I mean? Like, I get to tell you, you know, I'm a rabbi, so I speak in shul. And I look out into the room, and I see these teenagers, you know, who the fathers have force them to sit next to them for the rabbi speak.
Yeah.
And you're going to sit next to the rabbi speak, and you're going to listen to what, you know? And I see, like, there's no way I'm going to reach that kid. Because, you know, so you make a joke and you break through a little bit, you know? But like, you know, so this father, well, Elamai, what happened? This father was forced to sit through some godforsaken, you know, 35-minute speech when he was a kid. And so now it's like, you know, now you're going to sit through the speech because, you know, that's what we do. We pass it on to the next generation. So what have we gained in the end? So of course when the kid leaves, he doesn't have a positive association with. I think especially with something as challenging as tefillah, okay, which by the way, you know, I cannot imagine. It's something as challenging as getting, if your kid wakes up in the morning and says, I want to go daven there, I would not stand in the way of that in a million years. I think that is an incredible bracha. And listen, you've got to be aware of why they're going there. If they're going there for social reasons, but it's a positive social atmosphere, let's say there's a teen minion and they're going to hang out afterwards, but it's good kids and you know who they are and you know what's going on, so then that's fine. If they tell you they're going to shul, but really, they're like behind the shul, you know what I'm saying? And you don't know what's going on. So again, it's our responsibility to know what's happening and to know what's going on with them and where they are and who they're with and what they're doing like any other time. But if they say, I want to move forward, that's it. That's a bracha. So I would absolutely do that. The Malbim also has a beauty. So the Gra focuses more on appealing to their teva, to their nature, understanding their spiritual nature. And by the way, when they tell you where they want to daven, they're giving away a lot of information. Teenagers reveal a lot more than they mean to. You just have to be paying attention. You know, like every once in a while, you know, like you'll be standing around the Hanukkah candles and your cynical teenager who like, you know, doesn't like doing anything will be like, wow, that was really nice. You know what I'm saying? And they just gave up some information. You know what I'm saying? That they didn't mean to. About what Jewish engagement and ritual involvement, like what speaks to them. And that's valuable information as a parent to build on. You know what I'm saying? Like sometimes teens will, you know, like they're not afraid to tell you what they hate. I don't want to do zmiros. I don't want to do our Torah. I don't want to bench. I don't want to get up again. They're not afraid to tell you, but every once in a while they'll reveal like, wow, that was really, and that's a moment that you got to grab and you got to take advantage of and you got to be able to build on. Every once in a while a kid will come home from a shiur and start to tell their parents like what was said at the shiur, but the parent is like, are you kidding me? Like, I've asked you 1,000 times what you learned at school. It's always like nothing. You know, that like typical, you know, like whatever. And, you know, like monotone, zombie-like, you know, nothing. You know, and now you want to tell me like some, you know, Yatzvar Torah you heard at some Shabbaton, you know, that somebody told about a king or whatever. But that's a magical moment because the kid might reveal, like you might say, well, what was it that interests them? And all of a sudden you're like, you know, the Dvar Torah was about like why we should believe in God. And you're like, no one talks about that, you know. And maybe that's, they just gave it to you. They just gave to you what they're struggling with. No one ever talked to them about that, and we're going to get to that in a minute. So the Malbim, we'll get to the Malbim, and the Rav Kook is also very beautiful. But the Malbim understands this concept of Chanoch Lenar Al Pi Darko as really referring to the notion that one has to, that there's a balance. There's a balance in Chinoch. The balance is that on one end, we're trying to create what he calls Hergel. We're trying to create some degree of habit, religious habit. We're trying to teach them how to live life as a frum Jew. On the other hand, there's also the innovative notions that we're trying to infuse that speak to their particular personality. Rav Kook makes a beautiful point. I'm not going to do inside, but Rav Kook makes a beautiful point, and that is the following. What it means, Chanoch Lenar Al Pi Darko, is it's instructive to the parent. In other words, the child is developing themselves. They're at the beginning. They're just starting to discover who they are, what they think, what's going on in them, what's happening with them. The child's just beginning. The adult is already at the end of this process. Most of us, for most of us, our personalities are fairly formulated. And, you know, unless we're going to get involved with, you know, major therapy and upheaving our personality, for the most part, our personalities are defined. We've grown up how we've grown up. We have whatever, you know, capabilities that we have. We have our life pretty much where it is. And we'll change, you know, here and there. But for the most part, the fundamentals are what they are. The child at the beginning, it's very hard for a parent to convey spiritual and religious guidance to someone at the beginning who's already at the end. Because you need to put yourself at the beginning. This is what Rav Kook writes. Chanoch lenar, it's such a beautiful idea. Al pi darko, you have to be on his track or her track, not on your track. You have to be beginning where they're beginning, and not already be walking into it with all of your assumptions about what's good and what's bad, or what speaks to you and what doesn't speak to you, or what you find boring and what you find edifying, what you find interesting. You have to be able to see the world from their perspective. By the way, in Kiruv, this comes up all the time, you know, because you have people that are beginning the journey of Judaism, you send them to a firm person's, you know, home, and they don't really, it's not just, you know, so they'll like explain, you know, Kiddush and Hamotzi and all of these kinds of things. They don't realize how much of the cultural, how much of the ingrained sort of like, you know, habitual pieces of Judaism are so, you know, ingrained within us that they're like second nature. And for the child, they're starting from the very beginning. And so therefore, it's very important that we find a way to get into that. So I want to go to something practical. What time are we supposed to be? We have 45 minutes? What time do we start? Because my time's all messed up. I have 10:10. We started, what, like 9?
I have 9.
Anyone know? No one knows? Okay, so just fall asleep when you're done. So what do you call it? So I want to get a little practical. Here we go. A number of different grounded things that are important to keep in mind in terms of developing the spiritual potential of a child. Number one is, as we've discussed already, the notion of individualization, right? Every child has their own road. Every child has their own path. Multiple children in the same home will have different roads, right? Everybody thinks, well, you know, why is this child turning out this way? Well, look at the parents, right? Often that could be debunked by just recognizing the fact that the parent has multiple children, some of whom are following in one path, some of whom are following another path, and the parent will tell you, you know, straight up that they're pretty much using the same approach for all these different, you know, for their home. It's speaking to different children in different ways. So recognizing the individuality of each child and that different ones need different things. And this is very difficult in the home, you know? And our Shabbos table, some of my children are required to bench every word out loud because I know that they can, and I know that if they don't, they're being lazy, and I know that they can do it, and I know that they can focus on it, and once they get through it, they're into it. And some of them, if I were to force Chaim to sit there and read every word of benching out loud, I would be destroying his neshama. Because he can't do it. He just can't do it. Whatever it is, to agitate, to... He's not ready. He's not ready to read a bunch of words for 10 minutes and he doesn't know what any of them mean just because they have a dumb tune that he's been learning since he was 4 years old. It's just not stimulating. It's just not interesting. It's not as interesting as the bumblebee that's like flying outside the window. It's just not... He's one of those kids. There's nothing you can do about it. He's one of those kids. So is it hard to sit at a table and say different rules for you than for you and different rules for the people? That is very hard. And often we shy away from that because that makes us an evil parent, right? Because then the kids, right? Because if it's all about them liking us, then it's not fair. What's not fair? It's all over, right? Because, of course, life is pretty much about food, oxygen, and being fair. So, to a teenager. So, and the oxygen is, you know, debatable. So, you know, so at the end of the day, you know, there has to be a willingness to recognize different children need different things and to identify what they are and to shape that. And I have people in my shul who, you know, who've come to me. They have two boys. You know, one guy has two boys, two sons. They're 1 year apart. So he brings them to shul together. One of them can sit through shul and one of them can't. You know?
The
older one cannot. Correct.
Right.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Right? So the older one cannot. And the younger one can. But they're 1 year apart. So it's not like you can say, well, you know, when you're... Like, we tried that in our house for a while. You know, when you turn six, you can hold the umbrella candle. Now you have this six-year-old who's like a psycho. You know? Like, you know, you're like, there's no way we're giving this child fire. You know? Like, because, you know, yet you made this rule. When the kid says, not fair, I want to hold the candle. Like, oh, once you're six, you can do whatever you... You know? But, like, and that comes up, you know, when it comes to driving, you know? Yeah, some kid... I should not have been given a license at 16. Mm-hmm. Right? Lakuliyama, everyone agree with that? Especially people who were injured in the six-car pileup in Phoenix, Arizona. So the bottom line is that we have to be able to cater to different types of people, to different types of children. Next, this is very important. The tension between ritual habituation and depth and meaning. We train our children with habituation. This is what happens. I'm sure this is what happens in most of our homes. Child about 3-4 years old, and we're like, wow, wouldn't it be cute to do washing, right? So we put the child up to the sink, and we put their hands out, and we wash their hands, and we make a bracha, and they say amen, and everyone laughs, and it's so cute, and then the child gets a year older, and a year older, and a year older, and a year older, and we do this with everything, right? And the child's 14 years old, and the teenager is still sitting there going, oh, b'nai Yerushalayim, right? No idea what any of this means, no idea why it's significant to them, no idea. Very often, it's very difficult, because since we train them by habit and by rote, it's very difficult to say, stop! We never told you what any of this means. We never told you what this is about. So now the kid is 15 or 16 years old. They're saying benching because he told them they have to. They don't know what these words mean. They don't know what they're about. They don't know what the depth is behind this, whether it's tefillah, whether it's Shabbos, whether it's anything. All they know is they've been trained to sit here and do these things. We're going into the sukkah because we're into the sukkah, right? Oh, Pesach. So Pesach, everyone will have to say something at the Haggadah and everyone will have to say something. But then when we get to the rituals, we're all doing the same thing. You know, cut the thing, you know. So there has to be recognition that at some point in the teenage years, we need to be able to take a step back and to recognize that, by the way, this concept that we just train kids to do stuff that they don't understand, that's not the mitzvah of chinuch. The Gemara is very clear that there are different ages of chinuch for different mitzvos. And these ages correspond to the intellectual capability of the child to understand what's going on, right? You know the whole thing, you make Havdalah in the 9 days, you give it to the kid that's 8, but not 9, but 7, but not 8, right? Because you need a kid who understands Havdalah, but doesn't understand Churban Bayis, and that, right? That struggle in Halacha is about trying to determine what is the optimal age to educate a child, because the child's supposed to understand what's going on. So, okay, we raise them in from homes. I'm not suggesting we don't do this. We raise them in homes, and we train them what to do, and we habituate them what to do. But we have to recognize that once they hit the teenage years, it is time to stop and start talking about why we do these things. And they will appreciate that, and they will recognize that. And that will help. So that's individualization is number one. And ritual habituation and dealing with that is number two. Number three, dealing with basics. This is something I hear from teenagers all the time. We send them through 12 years of yeshiva education, and we never really talk to them about the basics. This does not happen so much in school. You should be aware of that. And it is an opportunity for parents to get involved in the foundation of a kid's spiritual growth. It, of course, requires that we know the basics. Okay, very quickly. Dealing with basics. Faith, Mesorah, how do you know the Torah is true? How do you know we really got the Torah? Why do we have to listen to rabbis? How do we know that they do, you know, that they're right? How do we know that, how can you have different perspectives on the same thing? These are basic issues that many teenagers do not have a grounding in. And very often that's all they're looking for. Very often they're struggling with these basic things. And it is an opportunity that we all, ourselves have to have a standing. There are many books we can get. There are many lectures you can get on tape. The 13 Ikarim, the six constant mitzvos, all of these kinds of things are very, very important foundations. And that leads to another point, which is integrity and hypocrisy. We talked about teenagers thinking that everything needs to be fair. If there's one thing a teenager cannot stomach, it's hypocrisy. So if he sees that their parents are preaching all of these things that they have to do that stand in the way of them having a good time, and they don't even know the basics of why we do all these things. They have no idea why we're keeping Shabbos, why we're keeping kashrus, why we're keeping... So why should they have to follow this? So that's a very important fundamental point. The next is the importance of encouraging asking questions. Okay, Judaism does not present itself naturally as from life as something that's open to challenge and question and critique. This is a big mistake with teenagers. It has to be that in a home, there is an atmosphere that encourages questions and challenge and wonderment. You have to encourage them not to be afraid of questions. If we know the answers, we'll give them to you. If we don't, we're going to learn them and give them to you. If we still can't figure them out, we're going to go together and find them out and give them to you. I cannot tell you what you will do for the spiritual growth of your daughter if she asks you a question you don't know the answer to, and you and her together go up to a rebbetzin or a rabbi or a teacher and say, "Hi, we're both here to learn the answer to this question." You have no idea. You've just done more than 3 weeks of school, because you have validated for them that the searching and the yearning and the passion and the desire is part and parcel of what it is that we're striving to do. So that's also very, very important, encouraging questions. And the fifth thing that's important is a culture of spirituality. We tend to be cynical about spirituality, especially in today's age. That is poison to a teenager. As soon as a teenager feels they've been put down, no matter how tough the exterior is, no matter how much they seem like they can handle and they can rank and they could whatever, as soon as they feel like they've been put down, that's it, we've diffused it. So if a kid is in shul, and they're davening with like a little extra kavana, right? And this is more likely a dad will do this, you know? And they take 3 steps back, and the dad's like, "Ooh, pretty stark." You know? That's it. You blew it. You know what I'm saying? That's it. That's never going to happen again. Because you just made fun of the kid. In other words, he just took all of his self-esteem, you know, seeped out of his soul. It's very important to create a culture of spirituality. And the last couple things, and I think these are really important, and that is that kids need to see that the values and the mitzvos and the observances of Torah make better people. They need to see that for us, that they translate into us being better people. They need to see that we're not just working on the Bein Adam Lamakoms, that the Bein Adam L'Chavero is part of our religion. It's not just part of us being a mensch, right? That's what happens. It's like, the matzah has to be this big and this big and this big and this big, right? But why do you have to help a person across the street? Because I have to be a mensch. No, it's also part of Shulchan Aruch. The Bein Adam L'Chavero, the integrity of being a good person, that also is an important piece. And the last piece that I think is really important, I'm sorry we're saying it on the way out the door, because I think it's the most important, and that is the following. Teenagers must see that being from and being spiritual and being real leads to being happy. If they believe that you are miserable by being from, they will not follow this. There is too much out there that is pulling for their pleasure. They will not do it because their grandparents were in the Holocaust. They will not do it because all their community is doing it. Because let me tell you something, they will get to some campus somewhere, someone will create the environment where they can make a different choice, and they will. If finances are hard about living a from life, that is not a topic for a Shabbos table in front of a teenager. That is a topic for a bedroom with the door closed. If the stress of from life is difficult, it doesn't mean you have to present a utopian, non-realistic portrayal of what your religious life is. But it means that they need to understand, of course we struggle, of course there are challenges, but at the end of the day, this is a source of happiness. They need to see that Yahdus makes us happy. There has to be something that we're overt about and something that we're open about. Anyway, this is really just the beginning of a discussion. I very much enjoyed spending time together. Certainly available if anyone wants to talk more any times. I apologize.